You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of the Body Pro. As CROI 2008 in Boston drew to a close, I found a chance to talk to Dr. Robert Schooley, who has been caring for HIV-infected patients since the beginning of the pandemic. He is professor and head of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of California in San Diego and chairs the executive committee of the AIDS Clinical Trial Group, which is known as the ACTG. I asked him to discuss what he felt was the most significant research presented at CROI 2008. Dr. Schooley, I was wondering if you could tell me some of the highlights of CROI 2008.
Well, I think from the therapeutic standpoint, there were not a lot of new blockbuster drugs, but the good news is that the new classes of drugs we saw last year continue to look pretty durable in terms of their effects, and no surprises have come up in terms of new toxicity. So it's reassuring that a lot of the hope that we had last year has been reaffirmed this year about new agents for initially, particularly for people with more advanced disease and drug-resistant virus, but as we learn more about the safety of these agents, we're seeing them move up into earlier patients, and these treatment options are good.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple of studies that have been talked about a lot, I think, and one of them people are talking about is the abacavir results from the DAD study. I was wondering if you could comment on it.
I can't because I don't really understand them. It's hard sometimes to interpret large cohort studies because there are a lot of things going on. The people doing the studies can in all good faith try to control for all the variables, but there are often variables that you don't know about or can't control adequately for. And I don't completely understand a mechanism for this or a reason for this to happen. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not real, and it means that we need to look to see if we can understand it and see if it's replicated in other cohorts, see if when GlaxoSmithKline puts together all of their abacavir experience, they see the same signal in control studies. There are a lot of things that this observation should trigger, and I'm sure is triggering, but you have to be careful about jumping on the first signal and assuming that what you see is what you've got.
So you wouldn't think that there's anything that needs to be changed in clinical practice because of it at this point?
I don't think we know enough to change clinical practice over this right now. I'm sure that, as with many things in medicine, what will happen is if there is a patient who's got several cardiovascular risk factors and you're trying to decide what drug therapy to use and you have other options that are just as good, you might say, well, maybe here until I get the data, I'll use another option. But you wouldn't want to compromise your treatment options based on what, in terms of suppressing the virus, which is what kills people, by choosing drugs that are virologically less active over a study that, although the study is large, the number of cardiovascular events themselves are very few and far between. The risk rate seems high, but when you apply that to the actual risk, the real number of people having heart attacks, compromising your antiviral therapy because of the perceived cardiovascular risk is something that people have to be very careful about doing. We need to understand it, and I think we will understand it soon. But in some ways, it's a microcosm of the discussions we had several years ago when we began to see lipodystrophy and some of the concerns about antiretroviral therapy. We understand them better. We know which drugs cause them and how to avoid them in most patients. But at the time those came up, there were people who had forgotten about how bad things were before we had the drugs, when we had people dying with six-month survivals after pneumocystis. So we are going to continue to have signals in which new things come up. We need to understand them. We need to move on. But this one is a single observation in a large cohort study that needs to be replicated in other cohort studies, understood mechanistically and examined and rigorous structured trials.
So no rush to judgment right now.
I think there shouldn't be a rush to judgment right now.
Okay, and I guess related to that study is the general studies being presented on HIV and aging and non-AIDS-related infections and malignancies. Can you comment about that?
Well, I think that as someone getting older myself, I'm at increasing risk for cardiovascular disease. I could increase that further if I could find some cigarettes I liked and would stop exercising, could eat more. So as any population ages, cardiovascular risk factors become more important in terms of their overall morbidity and mortality, and all of us need to work on it. The good news is that this is a problem we have. I mean, who would have thought in 1986 with the initial AZT study, which was a nice signal that there would be a way to treat the virus ultimately, who'd have thought that we'd be worried about people in their 70s having problems with cholesterol? It's great. We have approaches to that that we've been working on in the non-HIV-infected population for years, and it just makes us have to be better internists. And I relish the challenge. It's nice to have other problems to work on in patients that compared to the problems we had when they were irrelevant because we could do so little about their underlying disease.
Right, but how do you deal with a patient who's 22 and is thinking about this, hearing the news about HIV and aging and malignancies and all, and heart disease, and they're going, oh, my God. You know, should I take HIV treatment? They're kind of scared away from it, in a sense, from the news that's actually coming out of this conference.
Well, I think that the take-home message is that we know that the natural history of HIV untreated when you're 20 from what happened in 1986. We know what the natural history is. Its survival rates are much shorter than they are when the virus is treated. We know from the data from the SMART study that there are inflammatory markers that have an impact on heart disease if you don't treat the HIV. So treating the HIV may well lower your cardiac risk rather than raise your cardiac risk. You want to think about drugs that are less likely to cause cardiovascular risk, which is what the current regimens, how many of them are chosen. So what you tell a 22-year-old is the SMART study says that there's more cardiovascular risk if you're not treated than if you are treated. Being treated is a good thing to do from a lot of standpoints. Being 22 is a good time to think about stopping smoking if you're smoking.
So do you think that the clinicians right now are asking patients to make lifestyle changes to reduce these kind of risks?
We should be doing that in every patient.
Okay. I was wondering if you could comment on the news. I don't know if you followed some of the HCV news. The first kind of news was this growing transmission of hepatitis C in gay men, both in the United States and Europe.
HIV and HCV have a lot of parallels. We've known for a long time that each of the viruses is found in the bloodstream. We've known for a long time that each of the viruses can be transmitted sexually, although at different rates. HIV is easier to transmit than HCV. But what we're seeing in the HCV studies now is that the same people that were at the greatest risk for HIV transmission early in the epidemic, those with larger numbers of sexual partners, those with sexual practices that lead to mucosal surface damage, the ones who are more likely to be at risk for HCV transmission. So it's another reason that just knowing someone's HIV status is not the only thing you need to know when you think about whether they have protected or unprotected sex. There are a lot of pathogens that are transmitted sexually that include HSV, CMV, HHV8, syphilis, chancroid. You can go down a long list, and so this is just another example of something that has to be on that list when you consider about the risk of having unprotected sex.
Do you think clinicians in the United States, for instance, are, with their HIV-infected patients, are thinking about hepatitis C as a possible, are they looking at ALT levels and saying, oh, that could...
They should be, because about 20% of the HIV-infected population in the U.S. and more in populations that acquired the virus by injecting drug use are HCV seropositive.
Right.
So it should be a part of routine care of an HIV-infected person to look for hepatitis B and C.
Right. And wasn't it once considered rare for it to be transmitted sexually?
It still is rare for it to be transmitted sexually in HIV-uninfected heterosexual couples. And we don't understand all the reasons for that, but one of the reasons may be that we know that HIV infection leads to an increase in the amount of HCV replication or levels in the bloodstream that may make people more infectious. But the baseline rate in heterosexual couples has been low in the past and reflects the fact that HCV, as I said earlier, is a bit more difficult to transmit than HIV is.
Right. There is some connection, it seems, with the transmission of hepatitis C and methamphetamine addiction in the United States. Have you seen that kind of connection?
Well, I haven't seen it in individual patients, but the behaviors that can be unmasked with methamphetamine use are the types of behaviors that put you at more risk for mucosal damage and for the sorts of things that are being associated with HCV transmission, so I'm not surprised by those studies.
Mm-hmm. There was something about CD4 count initiation suggesting that maybe it should be even higher than 350, even though the DHSS guidelines just noted in December that initiation should be at 350. But there was a hint that maybe 500 might be the new interesting number.
Well, the when to start therapy question is one that has been going on for several decades, two decades at least already, and will continue. I have a slide that I made back when we were using 35-millimeter slides that showed the considerations in earlier and later therapy, and the point of the slide was that what we're thinking now is going to change over time as we develop drugs that are safer over the long term, as we develop more treatment options, as we understand better the natural history of the disease, there will be more reason to start early. If it turns out that drug development stalls, we become more worried about long-term toxicities, treatment initiation will be later. And what's happening now is we're realizing that many of the drugs we have are quite safe over the long term. HIV has its own risks in terms of morbidity beyond the easily recognized bouts of pneumocystis that brought HIV to our attention to begin with. And that with two new classes of drugs last year, it's not the concern about running out of drugs in 2 years is not the kind of concern we had several years back. The question about how to decide when to start therapy, I think, will almost always remain one that is based on consensus as opposed to a rigorous clinical trial and the preference of the individual patient. The attempts to do when to start studies in the past have all failed because at the end of the day, when a potential study participant is sitting down in a room to discuss the study, they say they would like to know when to start therapy, but they don't want to have themselves be randomized to figure it out. And so attempts to fill large studies with people in randomized clinical trials about when to start have not been successful, and there's no reason to think they'd be successful now. I think the other issue, and I think what is increasingly going to happen, is as we understand more and more about what the individualized risks are, that decisions will be made on an individualized basis. A smoker with risk for cardiovascular disease, as we've learned from this year's meeting, where these are the folks who are at most risk with unbridled HIV replication, might be somebody you'd start earlier based on the SMART study analysis. In the old days, you might think, well, gee, I'll wait for that patient because I don't want to put them at a cardiovascular risk. But as we understand more about the individual issues related to the disease, we can make individual decisions that are tailored to that individual patient. We have to get away from the concept that there is an average patient living somewhere in the geographic center of whatever universe you want to consider HIV inhabiting that should represent the decisions made for everyone. In resource-limited settings, we've often started later because the argument has been we don't have the resources to treat everybody. But in resource-limited settings where tuberculosis brings people to medical care earlier, we probably should be thinking about starting there earlier than in Los Angeles or in Boston. So I think we need to keep thinking about this in a less average patient slash global way and more about the individual considerations in individual patients based on rigorous data gained from a number of clinical trials. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that HIV medicine, like many other areas of medicine, is going to be best practiced by people who are knowledgeable about the data, thoughtful about individual patients, listen to the patient, and can make joint decisions with the patient based on individualized risks.
And in fact, isn't that what the guidelines say, that there's no upper limit anymore? It used to be do not start over a certain CD4 count. And now I believe the guidelines said it's recommended at 350, but no upper.
Right. And again, that I think reflects a little more humility because In the earlier days, we ramped the guidelines for therapy down when the randomized clinical trials with regimens that weren't as good as the ones are now. We then had cohort studies that initially said, well, you know, we can't show an improvement starting at 350 over 200, so you can wait till 200. But those were cohort studies that were done at a time when we didn't have a long-term follow-up. And as you might imagine, the people who had higher CD4 cells when they entered at such a cohort are going to take longer to have events accumulate. So in a lot of ways, making a decision early on in a cohort that the people who are least likely to have events are fine is like watching somebody jump out of a 10-story building, and as they go by the fifth floor, stay in fine so far. What we're seeing now with 500 is as the 350 CD4 cell initiators have been followed longer, you begin to see a signal that people who started earlier are doing better. And so it's not rocket science to understand why you're seeing that happen from the cohort studies. They're maturing.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Did you see the vaccine results?
Yes.
Do you think that this was expected? Is this making everyone feel very depressed about the hope for a vaccine in the near future?
You know, a lot of us have been depressed about a vaccine in the near future for a long time. We need to keep working on vaccines. It's an important goal, but we should stop planning as if we're going to have an effective vaccine. And the reason I say that is there have been a lot of plans made in public sectors about the need for care based on the premise we'd have a vaccine soon, and care and prevention based on the premise we'll have a vaccine soon. And if you use that as a rationale for not thinking about the fact that HIV is going to be here to stay for a while, you have a lot of people who should be treated who don't get treated. You have a lot of people who might come out to be tested for HIV if they knew they could be treated. You have a lot of people who, after being treated, might be less infectious. There are a lot of things we were not doing for prevention by this false hope that there was going to be a vaccine within 24 months or 36 months. I think we should settle into a mode in which we work assiduously on vaccine development, but we should plan public health interventions based on the premise that we are not going to have a safe and effective vaccine for decades to come. And if we get one, we'll all be delighted, and we can go to plan B, which is now we have a vaccine. And that's, I think, a much more prudent way to plan than to plan as if we have one just around the corner.
Mm-hmm. Yet, compared to vaccines, microbicides are looking a lot more hopeful than ever before.
I wish I could agree with you. I think there are a lot of agents that you can inactivate virus with. That's been true for a long time. But going from being able to inactivate virus to being able to have them be an effective microbicide in the clinical setting is a big leap. Again, the research needs to continue, but we don't have a microbicide around the corner either. And we have to be careful not to fall in the same trap that we fell into with the vaccine studies. In fact, every microbicide trial that's been done either shows that the people didn't do any better or did worse. So I don't see where the positive signal is coming from about microbicide hopefulness. Yes, we have a lot that should be studied, but no, we don't have any clinical trials that indicate that we're any closer to microbicide than we did 10 years ago that I'm aware of. Can you think of any?
No, I guess not, but I guess the recent global microbicide group is going to be studying Maraviroc because so there's data that might about Maraviroc that might be interesting, so I guess yes.
It's an interesting premise to study, and I support science in doing studies, but premises and a positive study have one thing in between, and that's the study itself. And right now, although Maraviroc is very well tolerated, may not cause the problems that some of the gels that were used caused on that may have enhanced infection, we have no more reason to think that Maraviroc will work than Anoxolone will work until a study is done. And so I support doing the studies, but don't start planning national policy on a microbicide being around the corner.
One other track that you may not have followed was immune-based therapies, mm-hmm. IL-2, IL-7. I know there's going to be big IL-2 trials probably presented next year, but is there any hope for therapeutic vaccines or immune-based therapies?
You know, I think that right now they're more probes of pathogenesis than they are realistic therapies. The HCTG presented a study with a therapeutic vaccine yesterday, and what we saw in that study was a very modest transient viral signal and a very modest immune response that correlated with people who better control their virus. We may learn from that what types of immunity we should be trying to enhance in future therapeutic interventions using immune-based therapeutic interventions, but when you compare the virologic benefit in the vaccine study we presented to the virologic benefit from taking 3 antiretroviral drugs, you're talking about the difference between walking and getting in a spaceship. We, I think, learned that virus-specific CD4 cells are an important marker of immunity that helps you control the virus and may be a very important marker to follow as better vaccines come along. But therapeutic vaccines are not around the corner either in terms of replacing antiretroviral drugs. IL-2 will increase your CD4 cells. We've known that since 1985. Are you going to want to take cyclical IL-2 with the attendant cost and toxicity compared to antiretroviral drugs that the guidelines panels are now saying there's not necessarily any upper limit when you should start? A lot of the premise about IL-2 has been if you start with IL-2, you can delay the time until you take these toxic drugs, to put it in quotes. But the previous concerns about a lot of the toxicities that we were talking about at the time the IL-2 study started, we're learning more about the context of those concerns, and the risk-benefit ratio comparing the two interventions is changing. So I would not be at all surprised to see that people who had cyclical IL-2 therapy could wait longer to start their therapy based on a CD4 cell-guided treatment intervention or initiation. But if you're sitting in Omaha and you're trying to decide whether to start tenofovir FTC and efavirenz or AZT3TC and atazanavir, or to start intravenous cyclical IL-2 followed by subcutaneous IL-2, I think the patients are going to will vote with their feet and will say it's a lot easier to take a pill once a day than to take a parenteral medication.
I was thinking more, I guess, of strategies for patients who are immune discordant. They might be suppressed and just can't get their CD4 count
But that's not
rise.
The study. In IL-2, those aren't the patients being studied.
Right.
The other thing to keep in mind, which I think is a very important message, is that the risk for opportunistic infections is much lower when your virus is suppressed at a given CD4 cell count than when it's not. And a lot of the risk stratification for which infections happen at what stage in the disease happened when we didn't have antiviral drugs that worked. And why that makes a difference is, suppose I'm sitting here with a CD4 cell count of 175, I've got pneumocystis on board, and I'm not on antiviral drugs. Pneumocystis reactivates, I try to respond to it, the virus jumps on my T cells, and pneumocystis causes trouble. If I have the same CD4 cell count and my viral replication is suppressed, pneumocystis tries to reactivate and my T cells are protected and can respond. So your absolute risk of infection is lower than people thought it was several years ago with the same CD4 cell count. So although having a CD4 cell count rise decreases your risk of opportunistic infection, you're still better off on antiviral drugs with no virus than on antiviral drugs with virus. And we don't know whether putting someone on IL-2 will decrease the risk of infection. There are some things IL-7 is doing that IL-2 isn't doing, but whether that will translate from a probe of HIV pathogenesis and immunologic restoration to a practical therapy is something that still needs to be determined. I'm a big supporter of studies looking at that because we need to understand the virus-host interaction. But from the standpoint of patients out there today thinking about whether next year I'll be coming in for my IL-7 shot, I don't think we're there with that either. Important studies, but not from the clinical intervention standpoint, ready for prime time.
There are no studies really at this conference, I think, exploring what to do with patients who have immune discordance. And I was asking the question because the association between being immune suppressed and possibly malignancies, and clinicians trying to figure out how to change that risk.
Yeah, and the problem is that it's a hard thing to know how to study. The event rate is low. So yes, people are at greater risk for malignancy with lower CD4 cell count, but the number of people who develop Kaposi sarcoma or lymphoma is low, and you'd have to find a lot of people who are at risk for these tumors and then do something to some of them but not to others to show the event rate changed. And that involves a very big study with interventions that we don't completely understand how to use yet. So I think that the risk is there, but how to translate reduction of that risk to clinical practice with the immune agents we currently have is a bigger goal than people understand. Because at the end of the day, if your CD4 cell count is 140 and you raise it to 270 with IL-2, you don't know whether your risk for lymphoma goes down to what it would have been at 270 if you'd raised your cells yourself compared to raising it with IL-2. And the only way you can know that is to do a clinical trial and compare the people who raise their CD4 cells to 270 to those who don't get the IL-2. And that's a big study.
I guess no one's thinking about it right now.
Well, I think we think about a lot of things, and you have to end up prioritizing where you think you have the best chance of success and where success will affect the most people in the most positive way. I think most people in your audience understand there are a lot of unanswered questions, and we all want to answer those questions. We have to make sure the AIDS research effort is not dismantled in the current federal budget debacle. There are a lot of pressures on NIH's budget, not just the AIDS budget, but the entire NIH budget. And the progress we've made has been dependent on rigorous, ongoing investigation. And for people to say everyone with HIV is doing fine, we don't need to spend time worrying about that anymore, I think is a big mistake at this point. I think what you've seen at this conference indicates that progress is being made, and there are a lot of questions we still have. You've asked some good questions today, and unless we have the tools to keep asking these questions, we're going to be in 2012 where we are in 2008, and I'm still looking for upside.
What is the things that some people can do who are listening to this to change that situation? I mean, could they write to the NIH? Could they write to their senator? Or
they can vote. Okay. We're all for voting, and they can read the platforms of people running for office both locally and nationally and look at who thinks healthcare and medical research is important. There are a lot of issues that challenge our country today, and healthcare and health research is only one of them, but it is one that's very important to all of us. And people for whom it's an issue should think about which candidates are most likely to push that forward as a national issue. We have to work together here. And mm-hmm. I think that I voted with my feet and went into healthcare years ago because I think it's nice to see people healthy, and we have a great country that can do that, and we need to elect leaders who share that vision, in my view.
Great advice, and I think if people listening want to go to AIDSvote.org, there's a bunch of things about different candidates and what their platforms are.
I've not been there and have no idea, but I just encourage people to get the information and go out and vote.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from the Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.